Good evening, Current Affairs listeners. My name is Nathan Robinson. I am the editor of Current Affairs magazine, which has just hit its 25th print edition. If you subscribe today, you can get the beautiful 25th print edition. We are trying to promote the print magazine on the podcast more, so this is me telling you to go to currentaffairs.org/subscribe onto the podcast. Your ear's finest hour of politics, culture, and tonight, your voice, because it's the voicemail episode. With me are Current Affairs financial editor Spikey Abraham.
Did you just call me Spikey?
Spikey Abraham.
Hello, Nathan. Good morning.
Current Affairs. Vanessa, your title is associate editor.
It's like money. It's all made up, Nathan.
Vanessa's here.
Associate.
Vanessa B.
Hello.
The poet at large. Kate Root is here.
Hi.
And our business manager, the woman who keeps the whole enterprise together, Allegra Silcox, is here.
Guten Morgen, Nathan.
Hello. Hello, everyone. So tonight on the program, instead of you listening to us, we listen to you, and then you listen to us. It's voicemail bag number... How many? We've done a lot of these.
I think 11, because the last one says X, which I assume is the Roman numeral, not like just an X.
Voicemail bag 11. Let's play the first voicemail. Unless anyone has anything to say. Anything important? Preliminary matters? Okay. Voicemail.
Hi there. My name is Justin, and long-time listener, first-time caller. I was just calling in about the discussion on the last podcast about, in the 90s, did our anti-corporatism movement sort of fail, or did it fizzle out? Something that I wanted to add to the conversation that I sort of expected to come up at some point, but it never did, was the trend towards crowd sourcing or crowdfunding different projects. And I bring that up because we were talking about the subscription model of different publications, or, you know, how it is that journalists are, you know, having to take corporate sponsorships, things like that. So anyways, I just wanted to throw that out there into the conversation that may have been an outgrowth of the anti-corporatism, things like the Patreons and Kickstarters and all that. But yeah, I'm happy to hear your thoughts on all that. And the other point I wanted to bring up about it was there was a bit of a divestment movement in the last few years, too, especially when you look at the Dakota Access Pipeline and Wells Fargo. And I think that may have also, you know, be a somewhat related type of thing where we're not divesting from, oh, I'm not going to buy these Nike shoes, but hey, we as, you know, a group of people, we're divesting from this bank because of this practice. So again, it was a good conversation on the podcast and, you know, just thought I'd throw in my 2 cents there. Thank you.
I don't think I was here when you all failed to talk about crowdfunding and divestment, but the listener wishes you had. Comments?
Yeah, sure, okay. That all makes sense.
Yeah, I think those are excellent points. And the divestment point is interesting because, like, one of the things you'll see happening, like, at the university level will be, like, students lobbying, you know, rightfully that, you know, Swarthmore College divest from ExxonMobil and all carbon, you know, related investments, but Swarthmore might still be using JP Morgan to, like, you know, like, that might be where they host their investment vehicles. So I don't know, like, I think it does fit into the conversation that we've talked about, but it's still like, we're still operating within these constraints that are dictated by, like, you know, who we even get to invest through in order to divest. I don't know. It's still pretty fraught. What do you guys think?
I think there's also, like, the same way that it's hard to talk about disinvestment in journalism without also talking about deregulation similarly, there's a lot of monopolies, particularly in tech, right? If we're talking about Patreon and Kickstarter and things like that, there's a lot of tech products that we use that if you wanted to stop using, you know, if you want to stop using Facebook, there's a lot more that you have to stop using than just Facebook, right? Like there's a lot of other places where Facebook gets your data from. So it's also, I think, just that the lines are blurred. In fact, this week in New Orleans, the city government introduced this new office that's going to do like everything, like safety and permitting and all of these other things. And they're like, well, you know, we want to open up the idea of what a business is. Like a neighborhood can be a business. It's like, okay, great. So it's not just that corporations are people. People are corporations too.
I have no comment on this issue.
Why no comment? You're the business manager, Allegra. This is business. This is your wheelhouse.
Yeah, but I'm a different kind of business. I'm not like the other business managers.
She's not a businessman. She's a businessman. This is a very narrow Jay-Z reference. We can get it.
I worked at a weird assortment of companies, from like a tiny German company that was part of parent companies to Newport News Shipbuilding, which is a subsidiary of Huntington Ingalls Industries, which does all of its work contracted through the government, to like a more common mid-sized tech firm. And they all had their own issues with them. Yeah, I think employee ownership, some kind of like crowdfunding for work in general is an admirable goal. But there's a lot of difficulties there. I think Vanessa makes a good point that you can't look at one of those things in isolation without considering where all the money really is.
Just from the perspective of current affairs, it's true that the rise of the crowdfunding model has been phenomenally important, right? I mean, our entire magazine was based on Kickstarter. This podcast runs on Patreon. And it has just changed everything in terms of how viable it is to be an independent media entity. It's just a shame that all the money still flows through for-profit companies when you think that it should be easy to get an alternative. I mean, Patreon's just a money collecting system, so it's unfortunate that everyone's still going through this giant entity that siphons off its cut.
Yeah, that's kind of interesting, right? Because like it's like the rise of the middleman, a whole new industry of middlemen who have been enabled by the move away from advertising, away from sort of like and toward this sort of, you know, anti-consumerist direct to producer, quote unquote direct to producer,
direct through the
right, direct through Patreon, which takes its cut.
Well, Spike, wouldn't you say to me that there should be like a public version of PayPal? Was this one of your notions?
I don't think so. Pete might have talked about this at some point. There definitely should be like a public electronic transaction system,
like that's the USPS for sure. Banking service.
Well, right. It could be through, like, there are a few different aspects to it, but I think, and like, I don't think it would necessarily eliminate the middleman problem, but it could make it simpler if it was just, you know, right now we have federal paper currency, but we have only private digital currency. If you have digital currency, that is only bank currency. It's not necessarily US dollars, but if you basically, like, this is what we talked to Lev Menand about. His proposal is to let people have accounts at the Fed. And if you had an account at the Fed, then you could have digital currency at the Fed and you could send that money to other people with digital currency at the Fed without having any bank intermediaries. Again, like you might still have to have Patreon to sort of collect and manage and distribute this in the right way, but it would at least be maybe a step toward getting rid of that middleman right now.
Tangent question. So I was thinking, you said it might not eliminate the middleman. And I was thinking about like fees and how the post office is expected to pay for itself. And that's why it charges stamps. And then my brain was melding this with the idea of the post office offering like basic banking services. And I'm imagining like a USPS Venmo that charges like e-stamps to pay for the infrastructure. Is that like a reasonable expectation that if the government introduces more of these types of services, that it should still charge us a fee to cover its operation? Is this even an interesting question? I don't know. I just thought of e-stamps and I liked it.
I don't know. I feel like I have strong feelings on this that I have written about before. I don't know if like others want to express their feelings, but my sense is that like the government charging at the point of service almost never makes sense for anything.
Even for stamps? Are you against stamps?
What about the collector, Sparky?
Can we write an article against stamps?
Yeah, I mean, I kind of am against stamps.
They should just deliver the mail. You should just give them the mail and they deliver it.
I just don't see why you would choose to fund it that way. I mean, you could, you know, you could differentiate. Like, why don't you just pick businesses that have, like, huge postal uses and charge them... Like, you could have a specific tax, right? But the point of the Postal Service, to some extent, is to cross-subsidize this essential service for everybody. Mm-hmm. And so, like, I just don't see the logic in doing pay. The only time you would really want to do pay at point of service is in order to influence people's use of a public resource, right? You never want to do it to, like, fund the public resource. You know, you don't want to charge people per gallon for water for the water that they need to live. You might want to charge people per gallon for water for like a commercial use that uses a ton of water. But at that point, it's just like a different way of deciding who to tax. And I feel like stamps are probably the same way.
We know that it costs more to get a letter across the country than the 25 cents you might spend.
Well, okay, 49 cents, so, I think, is where it's at right now. Let's
be
up to date.
Up, but I could ask my stepdad, who is very up to date on that, being a postal man. But yeah, it's almost like a nominal. I guess that I have this weird like sentimentality towards it. Like, it makes me feel good to give 49 cents to the postal service because I love them and I value them. But it obviously shouldn't be a barrier for people to be able to like communicate with others. But we have so many means of communications now that I'm hopeful that the 49 cents per stamp isn't actually a barrier for most.
What if sending letters was free, but you could still buy like fun stamps?
Well, I mean, at this point, I don't think that the stamp... Stickers. What's the word for stamp collecting? No, isn't it good?
Philately, isn't it?
Ugh. Why does it sound like that?
Yeah, it is. I mean, you could pronounce it slightly differently. It looks an awful lot like
Nathan shouldn't be allowed to say that word. Absolutely foul.
Wait, did you do the thing where you would like look for the stamps with a postmark on them?
No, I didn't care about postmarks.
Oh, okay. I think that's a thing some stamps
do. I just wanted colorful stamps. But yeah, it could just be that the Postal Service is a deliverer of packages and a seller of stickers.
Yeah, exactly. Yes.
How did we get on this topic again?
It was about crowdfunding and divestment is the question.
I said tangent. Sorry.
Allegra took us on a tangent. Okay, let's go to the next voicemail and we'll try and focus on what the person asks in the voicemail.
I don't see why.
Hi there, Current Affairs. So you put out a call asking for questions. So my question is, given the fact that Donald Trump is definitely not going to concede the election, what is the most likely constitutional way forward for the Democratic Party to remove him physically from the White House? Thank you.
There's really only one way to remove someone physically from the White House, which is you have to go there and you kind of pick them up and then you carry them out.
And why do we care about it being constitutional? Is that a bad question to ask? What's up with the Constitution?
I like that question.
Yeah, I don't think the use of constitutional makes sense to me here. Okay, here's the way I think about it. And like, I'm not a legal scholar. And
you kind of
I'm
are,
actually,
though, a little bit.
In fact, I'm very mediocre at the law. So I'm not relying on my legal knowledge. I'm relying on common
Whatever,
sense.
Whatever, Vanessa.
Yeah, like you are at writing and art. Just very mediocre.
So Donald Trump loses his election. The Constitution permits him to be in power until, you know, the next inauguration day. Like, that's the transition of power. And he can very much assert that he will not be leaving the White House, you know, like the day of the new president's inauguration. But one, you'd have to get... Okay, I guess this is assuming the Electoral College also, like all of this is all cleared out. And there is like a clear winner. Like, there are U.S. Marshals at the White House. U.S. Marshals, Secret Service, like basically all these federal law enforcement agencies would have to decide who they're answering to on the day of inauguration, like after that transition of power. And by that time, like, Donald Trump would be a private citizen. So I think it just seems to me like it would be really unlikely that those agencies, which are like physical people, would carry him out of the building, but they would do so at the order of like bureaucrats who are very risk averse. Like, I just don't think you could get them to view him as anything more than a private citizen at that point. And I feel like one good example of that happening is when there was a transition at the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau and Donald Trump appointed Mick Mulvaney as the director of the bureau after Richard Cordray left. And there was a constitutional dispute about whether that appointment was proper or whether the person who was the deputy under Mick Mulvaney should actually take over as director the Monday after Richard Cordray left. So on Sunday night, the Sunday night when like all of this was happening, the bureau had like basically two directors who disagreed as to who was the head of the federal agency. And I worked at the CFPB at the time. Were you there too, Sparky?
I was.
Sparky, you were there. And on Monday, it was, you know, it was unclear for employees basically who the director was. Like, people had opinions about who they thought they should answer to. But ultimately, the person who is the general counsel for that federal agency put out a memo saying that, like, they recognize the president's appointee as the director. And it could have gone either way. You know, there was, like the other person who thought she should be the director filed a lawsuit, you know, making very compelling arguments that it should be her in power. So it really could have gone either way. But at the end of the day, the institution went with, like, the least risky path, like, the path that felt clearest to follow, which is that, like, the person we recognize as the president has the power to appoint directors to head his federal agencies. And so it's not exactly the same situation that we're discussing with Donald Trump, but like, I have a hard time seeing all of these federal law enforcement agencies, the Office of Legal Counsel at the White House, agreeing basically to recognize the power that this person claims. It's not enough to say that you have the power to stay. You have to convince the institutions.
Because also the Supreme Court presumably will have decided that Joe Biden is the constitutional...
Forget the courts! What do you... Since when has the Supreme Court been helpful?
Well, I know. But I'm saying that, like, those people tasked with enforcement will have a declaration from the guy. I mean, if you just think of the way power is...
They'll have the very official paperwork that they can point to.
Yeah. Right? They recognize, they, like, judges mean something to those people.
To who? Right. Who, which people are you talking about?
I'm talking about federal marshals.
You guys are giving very nice, nuanced, legal answers, but, like, you know, maybe Mick Mulvaney won that fight because he showed up to the office early. He showed up very early on his first day. He got there before.
He got there at 7 a.m. with donuts that I would not touch for the 10-foot pole.
There's, like, a large extent, I mean, we all know that law is just a gloss on who is going to commit violence, right? And, like, there's also a large extent to which the people who control institutions are the people who are in the building and, like, have the email logins.
That's why I haven't told any of you, I haven't made any of you else an admin on our G Suite so that you can't usurp me.
Yeah. No, I mean, that's real. So I don't know what the answer, like, I don't know what would happen, but I would not rely on institutions at all.
The Supreme Court acts too slowly for the scenario that we were envisioning.
I mean, this is how civil wars happen sometimes.
Yeah, I think we haven't talked about...
Don't look so giddy, Sparky.
We haven't really talked about the role the media would play, which is that Trump has been very successful in painting other people as villainous, wrongdoing, kind of making him sort of the victim of how these institutions are wronging him. And he does have, I don't know the polling, but it feels like he has a lot of support and a lot of fervent support around this. So the time period between an election and when he would conceivably, you know, officially have to leave the White House, to me, that kind of general public opinion about the legitimacy of the institutions in general, if Trump calls him into questions and says, we can't trust the results of the election, I'm really the rightful winner, et cetera, the same way he's already trying to do right now by saying vote by mail is whatever he's saying about that being like fraudulent or bad. I think that has a big impact on what Vanessa's describing, which is what we could right now, what I think of as what would institutions accept as the least risky option. If there's the kind of protest that we have seen in the Black Lives Matter movement, I mean, that really changes what even powerful institutions think of as acceptable risk. So that's my biggest concern, is how well Trump has played the media so far. But to Sparky's point, you just got to get in there and get him out. Maybe threaten some of Trump's most precious holdings. Maybe that'll make him skedaddle, go to Mar-a-Lago before bad things happen to it.
I mean, I think, Allegra, you make a very good point, which is like it depends on how he is justifying staying in office. Like, if he is questioning the results of the election and the Republicans can somehow get, like, an investigation going, and then there's a lawsuit. Like, if you can muddy it legally.
So I feel like a thing that I've recommended people read before is the prologue to Jane McAlevey's book, Raising Expectations and Raising Hell, which takes place in Florida in the year 2000. And her desire to mobilize to get people in the streets before ceding this vote counting battle to the courts and losing. And I think that that's where we lose. We lose when we don't fight the right way between Election Day and Inauguration Day. If you're waiting for Inauguration Day, you've already lost. And when we talk about the militancy of like the current uprising, that's because nobody from the DNC is calling the shots. And when they are, they have a tendency to tell people, go home, we're going to find the most constitutional way to deal with this. And that's just another way to lose.
That's what happened with the CFPB thing, too, was they said, oh, well, we'll work it out through the courts. Meanwhile, Mulvaney had gone in with the donuts and started giving orders.
Show up early, bring donuts. It's a much better plan for power than what's the constitutional way.
If Joe Biden doesn't show up at the White House trying to claim it because Trump won't leave, that's going to be a problem.
I mean, the White House is harder, though, because the president lives there.
Yeah, no, that's right.
You can't really beat him there early in the morning, but you definitely got to go.
So, but do we agree with the premise of the question, which is that Trump will not cede power voluntarily?
Who knows?
Not necessarily. If he can find a way out that preserves his ego, I think he might leave. If he can find some story.
Guess we'll find out soon enough.
I mean, or we won't.
I was going to say, this is even sort of a semi-hopeful. I don't know. Don't ask me my opinions about
this. This is, yeah, right. This is assuming he loses. Okay.
Hi. You guys just did a article about health insurance for house pets, and I was wondering where everybody fell on the cat versus dog continuum. Thanks a lot.
The caller said, you just did an article, which we did, called Vetacare for All, about public pet insurance. And the caller asked, where do you all stand on the question of cats versus dogs?
I mean, look, does the caller want us to kill each other? What is the idea here?
Just wants to know where you stand.
We are pro animal, and there's really no reason to dig any deeper than that.
It's very difficult, actually, to do this podcast right now because Vanessa has two tiny, adorable kittens scampering around the room behind her, which is just unfair. Mm-hmm. Those cats are cute.
They're so cute. They're in a laundry basket right now.
I have a much stronger predisposition to cats. I enjoy all cats as a class, as a matter of course. Dogs, it's much more an individual by individual basis. I appreciate, you know, I don't quite understand the pet every dog people. I don't think that that's the best way to live. I think that, you know, you should say hello to an animal as you pass them, give them a nice greeting, but they might not want their head touched by you.
Yeah, my dog does not want you to pet it. Do not
pet
my dog.
Oh, I never pet without permission. Sometimes it's bad for their training.
And then two people who are very dear to me were bitten by dogs in the past 4 months, and both of them had to go to the hospital and required surgeries and stuff. And, you know, it's a tough world. So, yeah, cats rule, dogs rule. Some of them are fine, but...
I have been a pet owner of both cats and dogs. Is pet owner wrong? What's the right way? Pet lover?
Friend.
Pet cohabitator with cats and dogs in the past, and I've loved all of them equally. There's multiple ways to attack this question. One is the beloved YouTube channel Tier Zoo approach, which is to say which one is the most overpowered build in the meta that you might want to play. Unfortunately, the answer to that question is indeed dogs, due to a variety of traits that they possess. The other way is, what kind of pet would I want? And that is completely based off of your lifestyle. I have two cats now because I used to travel a lot for work and I lived alone. How am I going to have a dog? How does that make sense? That's almost an irresponsible choice at that point. Then third is, like, what animal do I think is awesome and just sort of want to be able to interact with in, like, a pet cafe type of situation? And I personally don't understand anyone who doesn't want to pet all God's fluffy creatures, even the non-fluffy ones in some cases. Though I have a little bit more understanding for people who are, like, anti-spider, because the leg question can be tricky.
Too many legs.
All pets are good.
Has anyone been to a cat cafe?
I have. I've been to a cat cafe in Tokyo. It was weird and great.
What? Isn't it kind of like gross Stinky. To have so many
it
animals?
It did smell
you?
A little bit, but the process when they fed all the cats at once was incredible. But see, I went now that I can answer this question several years later on a podcast.
Other opinions on cats. Look, dog people at Current Affairs are in the minority, but we exist.
Oh, it's you and Renix.
But you do admit that dogs drool.
Dogs do drool. Dogs, in fact, drool. Yeah, I mean, some dogs drool more than others. My dog doesn't drool very much, but I have had dogs in the past that have drooled a lot.
I like both, but I like that I don't have to walk the cats outside to pee in all sorts of weather. That's really what it comes down to.
That's true. They just pee and poop in your house.
In a box.
They're great. Plus, I read an interesting thing in an old advice column in the Washington Post many years ago. Sorry, there's a kitten on the screen right now.
Ah! I think the argument is being settled right now by the presence of this adorable
cute.
Kitten. Oh, by the way, listeners, every time you hear Vanessa speak, you need to be imagining two small kittens crawling over her in order to understand what we're experiencing.
Honestly, the cutest thing I've ever seen in my entire life. But this advice column made a good point. The columnist themselves was a dog person, but they they got a note from a reader who talked about, like, so dogs can be very healing because they provide, like, truly unconditional love. Every time you come home, most dogs are just going to bound to the door, and there's something very wonderful and joyous about having somebody who's always ready to come cuddle you, be excited, who's very drawn toward pleasing you. So they're easier to train. It's just a great feeling. And they can teach you a lot about loving someone unconditionally. Cats can teach you a lot about learning to accept the love that a creature can give you, and to give people space and, like, respect them where they are. So if you wanted to take it to a deep place like that, I think there's a lot of room to understand how different pets, like people, need to be treated and appreciated in different ways.
I love that.
Yeah, whatever.
Kate, can you sign on to that?
Can I sign on?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that I really do, on an individual by individual dog basis, enjoy some dogs quite a bit. My sister used to have a dog named Ralph who was very beloved and who I believe offered that unconditional love that Allegra referenced. You know, I have a pretty famously unfriendly cat, and I've been, like, having to travel the past few years, and now my neighbors tell me how much more loving she is when I'm gone, especially to, like, a couple of the men that live in my apartment building. And they're like, oh yeah, they say that she sleeps on the same pillow with Steve. And I'm like, yeah, my cat has never slept on my pillow ever. Like, the closest she gets is, like, the foot of the bed. But I think that she sees something in me as well that I don't necessarily want her to sleep on my pillow. So yeah, I think that there's things to learn in all kinds of relationships.
Did you get her as a baby, Kate?
I did, yeah.
Mm. Did she grow more independent as she got older, or was
no,
she always like that?
She wouldn't go near me hardly at all as a kitten. I always say she's not sweet, she's playful. She wants to play, she wants to interact, but she does not in any way want to cuddle.
All right, I'm going to play another voicemail since we've...
Did Nathan just get away with not saying any opinions about this at all?
Nathan doesn't like any of them, so...
Animals are fine. I like,
likes to
I
observe
like
them and look at them, but he doesn't want a relationship with them.
I'm not good with animals. All animals suspect me.
They're correct. They are right about you.
Yeah, I know. They figured me out. I could fool people. You can't fool animals. It's a problem. Okay. New voicemail.
Hello, lovely Current Affairs folks. My name is Brian, and I am calling from dyed-in-the-wool blue state, Illinois. Let me just start off by saying I feel like an insane amount of pressure right now to not, like, mess up this voicemail in case I come off as a stammering fool. But I did want to hear your thoughts on something I've been thinking about a lot recently. And that is motivating factors for people to move politically towards the left. You know, obviously, over the past few years, a lot of people have been experiencing this great moment of outrage, you know, as sort of the inherent suffering and exploitation of capitalism has been felt by more and more people. You know, and this sort of came to a head, you know, by Bernie's mainstream popularity, right, starting in 2016 and then even in the most recent presidential primary as well. But I guess what I have incredibly reductively assembled is the idea of two strands of left appeals that I sort of call the Jacobin appeal and the Current Affairs appeal, with the former asserting you should be a leftist because capitalism is horrible and the latter asserting that you should become a leftist because socialism is awesome. Obviously, I do agree with both those things, and I'm a fan of, you know, both your magazine and Jacobin. I read them both all the time. But I wonder, as you know, us leftists make appeals to outsiders to join us, you know, which strain of argumentation do you guys think is more effective? You know, what's the ideal balance? I actually say this as someone who is personally more motivated by negativity than aspiration. You know, I became more of a leftist by just seeing, you know, how horrible neoliberal capitalism was more than I was sort of inspired by, you know, Karl Marx's vision of, you know, fishing peacefully, you know, by your cottage or whatever. But so make of that what you will. But, you know, I wonder how much we as leftists try and capitalize on the current outrage versus how much we sort of pitch like a leftist utopian vision. You know, what is more motivating for people? So at any rate, you know, as I said, I'd love to hear the roundtable's thoughts on this. You know, thanks so much for hearing me out and listening to this voicemail. I love Current Affairs, and I look forward to reading and listening for many years to come. Thanks. Bye-bye.
The caller was saying that he believes there's a kind of two ways of convincing people. One is by pointing out negatives, and one is by showing the positive alternatives. And in trying to persuade people to join the left, what do we think is effective? So, positivity, negativity.
So if you say capitalism sucks, because what we have, the status quo right now is capitalism, I think it's really easy for a lot of people to feel that you're trying to, like, take away something from them, because that's all we know. So there's lots of positives in my current life that I associate with the status quo. So it sort of feels like you're telling me that how I live my life is bad. Whereas if you come up and say, hey, wouldn't it have been awesome if you didn't have to pay for college? I feel like you're giving me something. So I kind of like positivity, but there's also a lot of counter arguments that I will say, yes, you're absolutely right.
Yeah. I don't like trying to answer questions like this, but I will say that I think that, like, at least for, like, liberals, so if you haven't read Nathan's book, Why You Should Be a Socialist, you should go read Nathan's book, because I think Nathan does a really good job of this in his book, in that I think that a lot of people, especially who, like, identify as liberal, kind of have this dual thing going on where, like, a lot of people don't necessarily understand how bad things are and how kind of how much misery exists in our current system and how unfair it is, which is sort of the negative side. And then they also have a very limited imagination for what else is possible. You kind of think, okay, the things and institutions that we have that exist are kind of like arise from nature, and there's no other way that we can think about it, right? And I think Nathan's book is the best example I've read of, like, being able to address both of these things at once in the right order to say, you know, look at how bad everything actually is, and then to move seamlessly into and look at how we can make things better in kind of very easy and possible ways. I don't think you can really have one or the other. But I also think that the caller, by characterizing one of these approaches as the current affairs approach, sort of indicated probably where most of us are going to fall on it.
Yeah, my book follows the structure of Dante's journey into hell and then ascendance into heaven. So the first thing we do is we show you all the horrors we're like, look at the horrors. But I assure people at the beginning that I'm not going to just show them horrors, that then we're going to talk about like what socialists are trying to do, what socialists have historically done, what they stand for. So I don't quite actually accept the caller's binary. And in fact, Jacobin talks a lot about positive changes, and Jacobin, I wouldn't actually characterize them as a negative leaning publication, perhaps in a slight difference in emphasis, but I think both of us do the same thing, which is we're trying to integrate critique and something aspirational.
This reminds me of really good advice that I got in my first job, in my first career, like lawyer job ever, where like it was in a division where, like, people at the department who weren't lawyers would come to us and ask us, can we do this? And our job was to say yes or no. And, like, really early on, my senior colleague slash mentor was like, whenever you can, if you have to deliver a no with an alternative. Because if you just say no, people will stop coming to you. And, you know, like, they'll just either make their peace with not changing anything, or they'll, you know, they'll, like, change things the wrong way, and then you'll have to go and clean up later. So it has to be like, no, but have you tried that? And I feel like that applies in our arguments about capitalism. Like, yes, shit on capitalism all you want, but then bring a but and an alternative, you know, to like keep that conversation open.
And I think a corollary to that is the old improv standby, which is that you should yes and. So if your goal is persuasion, so I'm thinking about a one-on-one conversation more than like just what we should put out into the ether. In a one-on-one perspective, it really matters what stance that person already has. Is there already a chink in the armor? Are they already complaining about how they like can't pay their rent? Well, that's already a pretty good place to just point out why their life is bad right now, and I think they'll be open to it. Someone who's really successful and already has a negative impression of socialism as like gonna tax them to death, I think you have to really take their concerns and say, yes, it is like terrible that you're worried, you know, that your livelihood is sort of up in the air right now. And wouldn't it be great if there were social nets in place? Things like that. So when you have to interact with somebody, it's best to either give them an alternative when you say no, or always try to take where they're coming from and yes and them, rather than saying, you're totally wrong for thinking that you'll be taxed to death under socialism, because that's just not going to be persuasive to anybody. Did that make sense?
Yes, that makes sense. I think it's important to acknowledge a few things, particularly like one, I disagree with framing positivity solely in utopian terms. Positivity can also be an expression of solidarity or meaningful help for a person. You know, for example, just like in my DSA chapter Slack, you know, if someone says, I don't know what I'm going to do this week. I have my daughter and I don't have a car and I need to take her X, Y, Z places. That person will, of course, hear people say, I'm sorry, that sucks. But also someone very likely will offer them a ride, right? So that it's not just, wouldn't it be great? I know that sucks. It would be so great if in a world you had better transportation. It's like, well, sometimes the person needs material help. And I think that's an important frame, that we're not talking about just changing people's minds. It's not just, I want you to theoretically conceive of things differently. You want to change people's behavior in deep ways, including our sense of alienation from each other, our decision or our desire to not necessarily ask for help sometimes and to feel very alone. But also in the ways that we talk about politics and the ways that we solve problems. Sam Allison et al. Wrote a piece for, I think it's a DSA caucus, which is called Socialist Majority Caucus, but he wrote a piece about wanting to change our behaviors. And part of this comes down to even how we talk about them, right? So when you say at the beginning of a call, you know, pay attention to whether you step up or step back, that's still a sort of like reflexive internal check-in that's supposed to happen, as opposed to, okay, everyone in this meeting, we're going to assume that everyone's going to speak once and you don't speak again until everyone has spoken once or said that they don't want to speak. And that sets a different expectation in how people are going to regulate their behavior. So that's just what I wanted to bring up. I don't think it's all about this idea of, do we bring them to our side with positivity or negativity? I don't think that you can actually believe in what I believe, which is that there's no better world without us making better relationships. And therefore, of course, you need positivity. Like, people don't create good lasting bonds on negativity. That's just not how humans work.
There's no follow-up to something that beautiful.
I'm going to go to the next voicemail now.
Hey, love the show. Love what you guys are doing. Just had a quick question once and get your thoughts on things. My friend is having a little bit of a ethical dilemma, and I wanted to see your take on it. She's been working towards joining the FBI for about like 3 years now, and she's aware that there are some systematic issues, but felt like the FBI was a less problematic than other agencies, and felt that she was a strong enough moral compass to be a positive force in the Bureau and help change things from the inside. But considering recent protests and issues surrounding law enforcement and some of the items from the FBI and like blue leaks, she's now questioning if there's like an ethical way to join the FBI. Is it enough to make a commitment to herself to do the right thing, even if she gets fired? Just kind of curious what you guys think. If there's an ethical way to do it, what would you do in this situation? I'd love to hear your response. Thank you so much.
Because obviously the answer to that is no, but if the caller was asking about an ethical way, no, right?
No. There are places in this world that are so the work they do is just so against our ethics that you cannot, there is not a fucking ethical way to join it. Forget about it. Also, the FBI just like spies on people. It is so freaky. Take 5 minutes and find a leftist who lived in like a group house in the early 2000s that was like infiltrated by the FBI and was like, and like having that later be revealed. Like, it's so traumatic. The work they do is so harmful. I went to a conference once. I have never worked at the FBI for the record, but I was working at a federal agency that sent me to a training that was being put on by DOJ to like learn about how to do white collar investigations. So like corporate crime, you know, like what documents do you look at, da, 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 which I find justifiable. But they had a hard time filling the class because a bunch of U.S. attorneys had already taken it. So they ended up recruiting agents from the FBI, who sometimes are put on these white collar investigations, to come to the training. So I was there with like a bunch of FBI agents, and I got to know some of them over the weekend, and they were perfectly nice. They were diverse. Like, there was this really funny Black woman. One of the people I got along best that weekend was tattooed from his neck to his ankles. There was a lady who looked like she was like a middle-aged mom, you know? And all of these people told me fun stories about how many times they went undercover. And I was just like, my fucking God, they can look like anything. Like, it freaked me out. And they were like so casual about it. They were like, oh yeah, I was like undercover, and then I had to go to this car dealership. But then like I got a call from my partner that like there was like a car chase across town. So like I drove to the other side of Houston, and then like we were in the parking lot, and like my car was doing these like donuts, and I was just like, what? Who are these people? They were so casual about it. They can look like anything. I don't know if this will like resonate with our listeners at all. I can see the current affairs staff is making strange faces, so I'm mostly avoiding eye contact. But I was just so freaked out by it. Like, it was so normal to them. Like, they just infiltrate people's lives. They go in and out, and then they just move on to the next assignment. Anyway, like, I don't fucking know what your friend is going to be doing in there, but, like, what tells you that she won't be, I don't know, like, what makes you think that, like, leftist groups might not be, like, some of the people that she'll end up surveilling or, like, supporting the surveillance efforts? Like, you just have no guarantee. How can you expose yourself to that?
Get your friend a copy of Tim Weiner's Enemies, A History of the FBI, which is a fantastic book documenting the fact that the FBI has done almost nothing useful except spy on pacifists, communists, labor organizers. Not a good agency.
Look up Entrapment also. Entrapment post 9/11.
I've been watching The Americans, and I agree that this is, that you're just going to go into a world of hell where there's no possibility of making moral choices. And you can do that without being in the FBI just by being super anxious about life under capitalism.
Okay, I will say one thing about the FBI. Not to defend, I think the problem is that as a junior person or whatever, you're not going to get control necessarily over the assignments that you get. One of the things the FBI does, or did at some point, as The Intercept has reported, is that like they used to investigate the infiltration of white nationalists in, you know, local law enforcement departments, which you can, like, you certainly cannot trust the departments to investigate themselves. And, you know, like, until that program was mostly abandoned, they were doing a pretty great job. The FBI does investigate, like, they have a unit that investigates, like, political corruption and stuff like that. Like, I think there are probably context in which I would have no objection to their work, because I think corruption is bad, and I think white nationalist like infiltrations of police, well, I think police departments are bad, and I think white nationalists infiltrating them is also bad. You know, like, in those instances, that's probably fine work, but how the hell do you know that that's where you're going to get put in? Like, how do you know that you're not going to get put on the unit that has to go on Discord or whatever those like forums are to like to entrap some like 17-year-old Muslim kid into like, you know, purchasing items to put together a bomb that he didn't think of doing until the FBI agent planted that idea in them, you know, which basically describes entrapment. So it's just, how do you know? Why would you risk it?
I feel like we've had this conversation before, at least about like prosecutors and whether you can be an ethical prosecutor. It's kind of the same thing all over again. But I will say the thing that's occurring to me now that I'm not sure that came up before is like the arrogance that it requires to think that like you as like the individual entry level or lower level person are going to go in and like change the culture or actions of an institution, as opposed to, you know, that's already full of people who are very similar to you. Like, institutions are much more likely to shape you than you are to shape institutions. You're not a solid, stalwart, immovable object in the world. You are, in fact, a malleable, plastic person who is influenced by the people who you hang out with and the things that you do every day and the parts of the world that you encounter. You know, you end up being made as a person by the things that you do. So, you know, the person you want to be is an FBI agent, then you should go join the FBI. But if the thing that you want is to not be an FBI agent and to have the FBI be something else, then probably don't join the FBI.
Yeah, I mean, I would just make a list of why you want to and then find probably at least 50 other ways that you can accomplish those goals. Unless, like Sparky said, this is an identity thing, in which case... The other thing I would add is, if your friend is having these misgivings, there's a chance that she can't even join. And this is very, like, hearsay, but I had a friend who was recruited. She was a journalist in Virginia, and she was actually really creepy. She was, like, covering an event, and she turned around, and there were two guys in suits behind her, and they were like, can we speak with you? And they, like, got her to take this test, and she's convinced that she didn't make it. She hadn't decided how she felt about it, but she's convinced that she wasn't, you know, given the job because her answers to some of the tests weren't completely patriotic. Like, she was for whistleblowers and things like that. She's like, it's totally right to, like, call the government out, and she feels that that's really the only reason that she wouldn't have gotten the job. I have no idea if that's true, but I can imagine that whatever screening goes on really is focused on that kind of extreme loyalty to the institution that your friend, if they're having misgivings, might not actually be able to evince.
I try to be nice, but I'm still just very mad at the idea of someone thinking, like, I am so much better and stronger than every other person who works for the FBI that I'm going to go there and change the whole thing. Like, no, you're a person. They're all people.
Maybe they're pretty young. That's like an easy... This is like our grizzled view of the world.
This is not directed to the caller's friend necessarily. This is directed to all of the people I went to law school with who decided to go try to be progressive prosecutors. It doesn't work.
And like, if you want to be happy, just go some place that's suited to being happy, like I did at Current Affairs, a place where I didn't have to spend all day like doing mental gymnastics to figure out, like, is it okay that I'm just doing money so that corporations can charge other people money for like a thing.
This is the other thing. If your values really do conflict strongly with the values of the FBI, you're going to be miserable every day. You're going to be having to lie to your colleagues. You're not going to have, you're going to, like, your entire life is going to be built on a foundation of dishonesty, and it's just going to be deeply unpleasant. Let's end with two voicemails that are both on the about education. So I'm gonna play one, and then I'll play another.
Hey, Current Affairs. I'm a teacher in the New Orleans area, and in the midst of this COVID-19 pandemic, we're really getting close to opening up schools in some of the districts in person. And we know, like teachers and parents and people from all around know how dangerous that is. Why do you think, the education reformers are so influential over sort of regular people and our state and local school boards, which are supposed to be protecting us? I mean, it's kind of an obvious thing, but I just kind of want to hear your thoughts on the situation and what should teachers and educators be doing around this.
And the next one.
Hey guys, I just saw your call out for voicemails, and coincidentally, I just got an email from the principal of the school I teach at about what we're supposed to do in September, and the answer is fucking nothing. I am 24, I'm an elementary school teacher. I don't want to tell you where because I'm a little bit worried I might get in trouble, but I'm immunocompromised, and I've just learned that I'm just teaching a full class. I'm just teaching a full class of grade 5. They have just declared that elementary school is just going ahead as normal. And I don't know, man, people are going to die. And I feel so much empathy for all of my teacher comrades around the world, in the U.S. We're all going through this. And I don't know, what the fuck are we supposed to do? I guess, is that a question? I don't know. I just wanted to thank you guys for all the stuff you do. I really appreciate it. I really enjoy it. Stay safe. And I don't know. General strike, I guess. Fuck. All right. Bye.
General strike?
The answer to that is always yes. General strike.
Do we have words of comfort for these teachers?
I mean, I feel like the most kind of prominent reported on successful strikes of the last few years have been teacher strikes, so that seems like a viable option. God, those were hard to listen to, though. This is very sad.
I was watching a debate unfold online where teachers were saying that we're concerned about the idea of like teaching online full time. Like, that is also very difficult on teachers, like to just be in front of a screen all day. And to just like not, like, you're not going to get the same interactions with your students. And then there was a prominent journalist from the New York Times who was sort of like, I'm not saying teachers like should have to go back into physical schools to teach, but also what is the point of undermining or like, you know, trying to undermine the idea of them teaching online as well. And I was like, it's not undermining it. Like, these are real concerns. Like, something's got to give, and like, I have ideas, but obviously none of them are going to get funded. But I do think it's a lot to ask teachers to be like in front of a screen as workers, you know, for 8 hours a day. Like, that's not what they signed up for. It almost makes me feel like maybe you need to change the hours of the school day, and like what used to be what you could do with one teacher, you may now need to do with two, because people need to take turns, you know, and children will probably need like breaks during the day from online. I was kind of dismayed by the lack of imagination, and I was dismayed by this particular journalist's response, because the place she was coming from was very much like, well, if you don't send the children to school, but then you don't also give them like full-time online instruction, like the children are going to suffer. And I was like, yes, the children are going to suffer, but the teachers are also people. They are also labor. And, like, you have to, like, spread the empathy around. Also, I get it that you are at the end of your rope with probably your own kid. But, like, you know, this is all... I don't know. It just seems like you need to get more creative. But to get more creative, it will probably take more money. And I'm just not seeing that kind of zeal from even Congress. Like, I'm not seeing Congress being like, we're going to throw a bunch of federal funds at local school districts so that you can hire more teachers and break up the, you know, to do all these things that you need to do to, like, adapt to the temporary new normal. Like, these are the same people who have let the unemployment benefits increase expire. So
you've kind of skipped to the second thing, which is, okay, if we all accept that going back to the physical school is, like, bad and dangerous, then what are the objections to, like, full-time online teaching? And I guess I've been sort of out of the news because it's sad and I'm packing to move. But I'm guessing that one of the reasons... Yeah, New Orleans! I'm assuming that one of the reasons the kids are going back to school is because certain elements of our leadership in this country think that we should. Like, they think it's not too dangerous and that it's very important that we resume this kind of normal behavior. So to Sparky's point about teacher strikes, that sounds like a good idea, but do we know what percentage of teachers agree with this sentiment? Like, are all teachers against going back? Because I just feel really, really bad for our callers if they're in a minority of people in their district who think it's dangerous to go back to physical school. Because then you can't strike effectively that way.
Yeah, I mean, if you're talking about a teacher strike, I think it's pretty probably understood that you're talking about a year of work to get strike ready, to get to a 90% or more agreement to strike and to be willing to stay out, to have the strike funds, to have the community support. In New Orleans, I think our private schools are going back to school this week. Right now it's August 2nd. And I think that, yeah, I mean, New Orleans is also just, you know, we live in the slight future to the rest of the country in terms of the complete destruction of our school system to a bunch of largely unaccountable groups of people who make decisions. I agree with Vanessa. I mean, I don't know. You know what I mean? It's the similar inability to deal with a problem. Everyone knows what the correct response to the coronavirus pandemic is that you pay everyone to stay home. And so everything that gets around that is going to fail.
This is Nathan, why would you end the podcast?
I'm sorry to end on the one with the schools where the fewest good answers available because every single thing we can imagine is horrible. You don't want parents to have to teach their kids. You don't want kids to have to go back into schools. You don't. None of it works. Okay, well, we've been useless. But we would like to extend feelings of solidarity and warmth to all of our teacher listeners who we know are facing one of the hardest jobs in the country right now, and parent listeners as well, yeah. And all listeners, really, because it sucks. Everything sucks for everybody right now.
I hope we have child listeners.
We have child readers, so I'm sure we have
some. We gotta prevent the children from wanting to join the FBI when they're young.
Hey, kids. If you're considering joining the FBI, don't do it. We'll give you some literature. This has been the Current Affairs Voicemail Bag episode.
I just want to say one positive thing. My hometown, Kansas City, and where I live now, New Orleans, both shut down eviction court this week. And while that's not a direct corollary to schools opening, anything that demonstrates and builds power in an immediate sense, in a material sense for the working class, helps. So even though, you know, again, it's not that, as much as I wish that five people spending a morning talking to each other on a podcast could help us figure out the way out of capitalism, probably not going to happen. But there, it's important to pay attention to what is going on in your community that is building power. Another thing that's happening in New Orleans is just there's a lot of mutual aid happening around trying to keep people fed. So that's it. Just be on the lookout, even if you see a lot of, even though we just finished on the most depressing question ever. Again, Kansas City and New Orleans both shut down eviction court this week, and that was pretty cool.
That footage was amazing. Go New Orleans.
Yeah, just to be clear, the cities didn't shut them down voluntarily. They were forced by the action of people. Listeners, you can always call the Current Affairs voicemail line at 504-867-8851. That's 504-867-8851. I've been Nathan Robinson, and I've been joined tonight by business manager Allegra Silcox.
Good afternoon.
Poet at large Kate Root.
Bye, everybody.
Financial editor Sparky Abraham.
Goodbye.
And associate editor Vanessa A. B.
Good night.
This has been Current Affairs. Thank you.